The Gambling Files Podcast, the podcast that doesn't touch itself when it thinks of you. Hello and welcome to The Gambling Files Podcast. I'm your host. I have no hair. My name is John Bruford. I'm joined by Fintan Costello. Hello, Fintan.
Hello, John. Everything okay? We good?
Yeah. I was just kind of channeling movie stars of yore.
Okay.
I started off with Peter Lorre in my head, but he's never had that voice in his life. And then I kind of worked my way down. I leaned towards Jack Elam, realized he really probably only had a gruff voice once. And wound up in some sort of sub Lon Chaney, but in a silent era. Because, you know, if it's a silent film, they could be doing any voice.
True. Very true.
So, Fintan, we've got a great episode lined up. But before we get to that episode, I'd like to discuss some of the topics in the world today.
What's going on in the world today, John?
Well, there's a lot of crazy shit going on, Fintan.
There always is.
No, it's crazier than it's ever been.
Like what?
Well, Fern messaged me last night. She was like, I'm just looking at all the politics stuff in the US and looking at the candidates, and they're all wankers. Her words, not mine. I'm not judging anybody yet. And I'm like, have you seen this guy? And she's like, who? I'm just going to go find him.
Oh, is it the guy who's lying about everything?
Everything.
Like literally, my favorite one was where he claimed to be Jewish.
Oh, fuck, don't.
And then said, no, I'm Jew-ish. Which, in fairness to him, is probably, it is a fantastic pun if you were trying to be funny. But as you know, if my 11-year-old came in with such a shite excuse for some blatant lie, you'd just be like, that's ridiculous. But an elected politician thing. Yeah, it's a bit weird.
But it's that he's lied about fucking everything.
Oh yeah,
two questions stem from this, right?
Yeah.
If you're found to be utterly unsuitable for office on an ethical basis, as in you fucking lied about everything, how do you keep your fucking position? But number two, and this is quite important, if I was starting a job, my references would be checked.
But
nobody check his fucking references.
References don't get checked that hard. But the thing is, like, look at, you know, every country's got issue with politics and politicians lying. Boris Johnson's a great example.
It's the only time you'll ever hear Boris Johnson and great in the same sentence, unless the sentence is Boris Johnson is a great big penis.
My favorite one from Irish politics, he became Prime Minister, Bertie Ahern. But when he was Minister for Finance, he didn't have a bank account.
Oh, that is quite good quality.
Right. So he kept everything in cash. And then there was a whole scandal around like getting kickbacks from builders and business people and all this kind of stuff. So they hosted like a dinner for him during Cheltenham. And so he came back with like a ton of money from that or something like that. And then when they were doing the tribunal and stuff later on, his excuse was that he like had a really good day at the races and he won a load of bets. And then somebody sat down and worked out how much he'd have had to gamble. And he would have had to win a winning bet on every horse race for the week, kind of thing. So, you know, politicians lie; they're all lying.
Yeah, but you kind of—they're
all
shading the
truth.
Surely got to be a point at which you say enough's enough. You know, Bertie Ahern, and you could have used the word. And apologies if my pronunciation is wrong. You could have used the word Taoiseach, and we could have
Taoiseach. Taoiseach.
But I like Taoiseach because I like to think, no, I never wear those. and we could have all learned something. Of course, Bertie Ahern's daughter is a huge selling author, Cecilia Ahern. And she, I mean, I'm sure there's absolutely no connection whatsoever between having wealthy parents and having the freedom to become an author. Because I've got loads of fucking stories to tell, but honestly, I don't have the time to sit down and write them out. It just doesn't work like that, unfortunately. And unfortunately, authoring and writing and that kind of shit, it's pretty much the reserve of posh kids. And journalism is going the same way.
Always has been, though, hasn't it?
No, there's been some great working class authors down the years. There was the one guy who...
Yeah, but I'm not saying there hasn't been great ones, but in general, it's, you know, the preserve of to be the starving artist, you know, it helps to have somebody paying your rent.
Yeah, it does. If anybody wants to sponsor the podcast in a completely unconnected aside. But speaking of which, we should give mention to our corporate overlords. Do you see how I've done two neat shimmies there?
That's good. It's like watching Muhammad Ali in his prime. It's just like, boom, can't touch it.
Very, very similar. Our corporate overlords at GRS Recruitment, if you have any recruitment needs, give them a shout because they're awesome.
They are great.
And we will be having Paul back on quite soon, probably maybe the week after ICE.
That'll be a good one.
The week after ICE to talk through some recruitment-related stuff. Can you remember what the web address is?
Oh, you got to get it right. Hang on a second. Let me get it right.
Well, that's why I'm asking you it, because I'm clearly not going to get it right.
Because they've got somebody with a similar name.
Some Rob Dog, some cyber squatter.
It is grs-recruit.com.
Excellent.
Except no substitutes.
I will just add one last thing about George Santos. Mm. He looks like a proper slimy twat, doesn't he?
But they all do.
He looks like a ventriloquist dummy come to life.
Pick any politician you wouldn't slap. Like, just...
No, there is one. There is one.
Who?
Just give me a minute.
To enter politics, like, you just...
Ken Clark.
Fair enough. You found one. You have to dig deep and you found
it
one.
Take me a little while.
Good work. Right. That's it, like, for anyone to enter politics, like, just you're automatically questionable.
No, but seriously, I look at this guy and I'm thinking somebody has got their hand up his ass working his mouth.
And that's probably a great weekend for him. And that's, you know, that's his thing. But I don't know.
George Santos campaign funded by Crypto Cash.
They all are, though. Like FTX.
So says Bloomberg.
FTX was bankrolling. They've all taken money from FTX. They're all at it. They're all like, okay, this guy's a pretty extreme example, but they're all shite.
It just robs you of your faith in... So some people out there would do things for the good of their community. They would do things because they're the right things to do.
But that doesn't get you... But the thing about like all politics globally now, it's such a money game. Because you need money, and particularly in the US where it's so media, like the amount of money you need to advertise to get elected.
But just imagine if you had a completely level playing field and you took that shit out of it.
Oh, for sure.
Because you could do this. You could say to the representatives, you could say, right, here's what we're going to do. What we're going to do is you're going to get half an hour of TV time. You're going to get half an hour of TV time. It's all going to be free.
The thing is,
you have debates. You don't pay anything. You get X amount of free advertising from these publications. You all get the same.
It would help, but if you look at say the UK politics, right? So let's take the Russian interference in the Conservative Party, and some of the
alleged Russian interference
in the Conservative Party. Like we're talking like $50,000. Now, in the scheme of things, for that's a lot of money. But if you're a government trying to influence another government, $50,000, nothing. You know, it's you know, they spend more money on coffee in the fucking, you know what I mean? And it's such an easy, corruptible thing anyway, that the amount of stuff you need to put in place.
If anybody wants to influence this podcast, we are considerably cheaper than a government.
Probably more effective as well.
I don't know. We've got to get the dude on. Speaking of which.
Do you think he'll come on?
No, I don't.
I'd love to bring one.
But do you see the news about the UK white paper? And the dude saying...
What did he say now?
He was saying, look, it's not going to be that scary. It's not like affordability as such. It's like... He implied that the white paper is not going to be the kick in the balls that everybody's been assuming.
It's a very... Why would you come out in public and say that? Because all that does is just rile up anybody who's anti...
I'm honestly not sure. I mean, he was addressing... Who's he addressing? It might have been the BGC, actually. But he was addressing some group or other, and it's been very, very widely reported.
But that's, like, why would you go out in public and say, oh, it'll be fine? Like, Jesus Christ, that's just fuel on the fire for any of the anti-gambling lobby.
Yeah, but he's probably worried about getting lynched.
Well, I suppose you can't get up on stage and say, yeah, it's going to be a shit show, because then it means you failed.
Well, the other thing is, with this particular government and with this particular ruling party, I'm not going to believe anything they fucking say until it's delivered.
That's the thing, right? As long as, yeah, it's... I'm sure there's a lot of stuff going on behind the scenes.
But don't forget, GRS Recruitment for all your recruiting needs.
Who have we got on the show today, John?
That's a great question, Fintan. We've got Stephen DeMar of Oddsworks, and he talks about his awesome brother.
So
he does, though. No, he talks about the business, about where it came from, about being an older person in the industry, and the benefit of many years of experience, but also their I think unique model.
It's brilliant.
It's very clever.
I'm such a fan. So they are a smaller, obviously in America. So online slots. The background is the slots industry and the gaming industry in America. They've got the licensing. They've got the integrations into major online casino, regulated online casinos in the US. And they are a platform for game providers to access the US market. So if you're a game studio in Europe or anywhere and you're looking at the US market to get access in terms of getting your licensing, getting your product licensed, the cost and the number of years to go through that, they can significantly speed up your market entry. Really good bunch of guys, really smart team. Their backgrounds, like if you go through their CVs, it's just ridiculous. Like there's nothing they haven't done. The intelligent brother invented Defender, which for any of the classic video game people out there is just like...
That's just crazy.
That alone.
Yeah, he could have come on just on the basis of that.
Which of them was in the Pinball Hall of Fame, our second Pinball Hall of Famer? Oh, the brother as well.
Yeah. It's Steven's brother. We got the poor relation.
Well, we got the handsome one. Let's not forget. So Stephen brought the looks. So
wish, though, that we'd recorded video so that we could prove that.
Super cool guy. Really switched on. And they're doing great stuff. So really interesting chat. And yeah, give it a listen.
We move to our one and only guest on this episode. You know, the new format. If you want to give us any feedback on that, if you want us to go back to the dark, grim, sad old days where we'd have multiple guests on, then please let us know, because we might read it. You never know. Fintan and myself are joined by Stephen DeMar, the Executive Vice President of Oddsworks. So clearly a very important man. Stephen, welcome.
Well, good morning to me. Good evening to you, gentlemen.
That's a very astute greeting. Not all of our guests are so clued up as to the fact that we are in very different places. Stephen, you join us from sunny Chicago.
I'm having coffee. You're drinking something a little stronger. So
this is opium.
Cool.
I was traveling and I just got used to the taste. Fintan, do you have a drink?
Water in a branded bottle, because, you know, I'm very always on brand.
We're going to have to start doing video on this, because then everybody would see that it's in fact glue. Oh, get my coat. Stephen, what does Oddsworks do?
Oddsworks is in the business of providing game content to the online legal casinos in North America.
Okay, now that's pretty competitive, I would think.
It's actually, at this point, not terribly competitive. The barriers to entry are so high and so long to get gaming licenses that the real major competitors are just the giant gaming companies. Little just, people are not in this.
Just the giant gaming companies.
It really is. That's kind of how we entered the business. We came from being a game studio where we were feeding games to IGT for about 20 years. And we were a very, very steady, consistent game provider, and were able to get our games to market. As time went on, it became increasingly difficult for an independent game studio to get games published. And that's a pretty universal problem for indie studios right now.
Yeah, and certainly, over the last several years, there's been an awful lot of studio acquisitions by gaming companies, and, you know, exclusivity deals and blah, 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 all of this kind of stuff. So, you know, it's a shame that, it's an extremely, I would say, extraordinarily creative industry, but one that has this incredible bottleneck, which is, you know, you kind of wonder where things might go in terms of development of games, in terms of the evolution of games and gameplay, if that sort of throttle, in the sense of a choke, was taken off. I don't know where I was going with that. I just started rambling.
Yeah, I'm not sure that in the scope of my professional career, that change is going to happen. Right now, there is a bottleneck. There is also a shortage of locations, meaning states, to make it really worthwhile for a lot of people to enter this market. The independent people are the ones that are being boxed out. IGT, Light and Wonder, Konami, they're all there.
We have a special name for them on this show. We call them Industrial Light and Gambling.
Yes. Yes.
So Oddsworks is an independent. Is that correct?
Yes. Yes, we are privately owned. There are three of us that own the company.
Okay. So how do you survive in amongst these juggernauts and behemoths?
Great question. David and Goliath. It is really that simple. The manufacturers have generally been pretty aggressive in enforcing their will on the casino operators. And they are in many forms oligopolistic, where they just say, this is what we're doing, this is how you're doing it. And there is a resentment in many cases from the operators. We are a little warm and fuzzy company. We've all been in business literally for 30 or 40 years. We know everybody, and we're an upstart company. So the refreshingness is what is getting us in the door of all the operators.
Just for the benefit of our listeners, and stop me if I'm being rude, or possibly Fintan, jump in if I'm being rude. Stephen, you're a mature gentleman.
Yes.
I think it's fair. And I mean mature like a fine cheese.
No, old.
Old like a fine cheese.
You could have said wine or whiskey.
Okay. Yeah, I'm an old guy.
I was getting to whiskey. But you know, I mean, are your partners in this equally whiskey-like?
No, well, my brother is 2 years younger than I am.
So do you often mock him for his youth?
Non-stop.
It's fair.
Non-stop. And then the question is, which is the smart one, which is the pretty one, is the other question.
The age-old debate between all brothers everywhere.
You say that, Fintan, but can you imagine me having that argument with my brother when the answer is so clear to both of us?
I don't know. I haven't met your brother yet.
Well, you just have to take my word for it.
Okay. And our third partner is in his mid-50s. He is in the prime of his career and is the CEO. He came from big corporate America. He is capable of running public companies.
He sounds like a real upstart.
Oh, he's a great guy. We've known him and been in some form of business with him for literally 30 years. My brother hired him at Williams Electronics when I think he was employee number 4. Ultimately, that became Light and Wonder. It went to WMS, then it was Cy Games, now it's Light and Wonder. But it started as Williams Electronics. It made pinball machines.
So when you were there, was it pre-WMS and was it during the pinball?
Yes, and the video games. My brother is most famous for designing a game called Defender.
Oh, wow.
Robotron.
Wow.
So he is a real deal game designer.
Well, hang on. Why haven't we got him? What are we doing stuck here with you?
We got the wrong brother.
We did.
You got the pretty one.
Should have done video.
Actually, he's in Hawaii right now on vacation.
Sucks to be him.
Yeah, it sucks. It's terrible. Actually, you know what's really bad about Hawaii? It's a local call on a cell phone. It's no different than calling Indiana from Chicago. So we're able to antagonize him with business issues.
Good, good. Well, you don't want him getting too comfortable. Like, 2 margaritas is too much. You know, you got to keep him on his toes. I agree with that.
No, that's a pretty legendary claim to fame. If I had designed such a seminal game, I would probably have a declaration that I designed it on a t-shirt, on a hat, on a tattoo. You know, I would be attempting to dine out on it every day, I think.
Well, I'm reading your brother's biography on the website, and it doesn't mention it.
What? Really?
Yeah.
At Oddsworks website?
Yeah.
Okay, go to Wikipedia.
I'm not doubting you. I'm just like, if it was me, it would be everywhere. I ran a race last year, and I constantly wear the merchandise just to remind everybody I did the race last year.
Anybody that is not able to see, which is everybody, he is wearing his Marathon des Sables hoodie right now. And it looks to me like it's brand new. So I think that's probably his second one.
Oh, the 2023 merch has dropped, and we've had to do it and make sure.
Oh, my God. But I mean, that's some incredible experience in the company.
It's incredible.
So, well, I've got to ask, are you in the Pinball Hall of Fame?
Larry is, yes. We actually support it. The one in Vegas. Yes.
Fintan, I'm going to have to claim Larry as being on the show so that we can say we've got our second Pinball Hall of Famer on the show.
Tim Arnold is a very good friend of ours who owns the Pinball Hall of Fame.
Is that how you got in then?
No, actually, he came from Michigan. He had arcades, and he sold his arcades and opened up in Vegas in an old abandoned farmhouse that was nowhere. Now he's right by the Welcome to Las Vegas sign, and he's got a real, real successful operation, and he gives all of his profits to the Salvation Army.
Wow.
Well, the Salvation Army in Las Vegas is a huge and vital operation. They're very, very busy. But we had a gentleman by the name of Tom Neiman on. Well, we've had Tom on several times, and Tom is also a Pinball Hall of Famer. Tom was at Bally, and was the gentleman that pioneered licensed tables, as I recall.
Yep, he started with what was it, Pac-Man, was it?
No, Pac-Man was his gold record. His first table was Tommy, I think. His first licensed table, I think, was to tie in with the Tommy movie, which would obviously make a lot of sense. You might not know that.
Tammy Pinball.
Yeah. Yeah, because Pinball Wizard, you know the song, Fintan?
Ah, okay. Okay.
That's from the rock opera. Because when it's rock, it's not a musical, it's a rock opera. Okay. About the blind, deaf, mute pinball player, Tommy.
Sure plays a mean pinball.
He really does. Played in the movie by none other than Roger Daltrey. It's a good fun film, kind of. It's mildly disturbing. But anyway, so Stephen, this, I don't know how to ask this in a polite way, but you know, there's a lot of experience in your team. Now, I've heard it said, I may have said it myself, that, you know, the gambling industry, it is quite a young industry. Do you think, I guess, experience is a priceless thing. I mean, it's invaluable and unvaluable. That word was better in my head. Do you think that it's that experience that keeps you competitive in, you know, against the behemoths and the juggernauts and the Industrial Light and Gamblings?
Well, the first thing is we started once upon a time, we're young. And most of the people, as you mentioned, in the industry were young, even younger than we were at the time. We were probably the age of middle management. When we started in the slot machine business. At this point, our Rolodexes are so big. You guys probably don't even know what Rolodex is. But our sphere of people is so big that we are on a first name basis with anybody in the industry or are a phone call away. That's been a real big advantage. Now, the young developers, the kids that are 22 years old, we're a million miles away from them. I would argue that we are too fossilized to be designing games at this point. But we understand the process and the distribution and the people. And, you know, we can spot things that are good. We just don't design anymore.
So how does your process work then in terms of game creation, in terms of sort of talent and game creation?
Good. Let me go backwards. Larry and I owned a studio for about 25 years, and we licensed our games primarily at IGT. Our partner, Sridhar Joshi, who's the younger man, started his own studio and was licensing games all over Europe. He was mainly doing online and very successful at it. As you know, Europe became very difficult in terms of there's was a glut of games. There's just too much content in Europe, and the life expectancy of a game is the attention of a fruit fly. So the economics of making games, there's no economics anymore in Europe. And there's no throughput in American manufacturers. We couldn't get our games through. So we retired. Both my brother and I retired probably about 4 years ago. And we're pretty happy about it. Sridhar came in and said, hey, gambling is coming to the United States. Let's go into the online real money business. We bought a remote game server. We got licensed. We are licensed in the States. And we are a conduit for all these independent studios like we had that have no way to market. So we are at a point where we are very, very selective at this point because we have too much content. Is the only real way for an independent to get to the North American market.
Wow. And so this, okay, so I completely understand. So because if I'm an independent game studio, so I'm a couple of smart kids sitting in London or Stockholm and
we're right, making, in the basement or in the garage.
We're making our games and we want to get our game out in America. I would then have to, as the little independent studio, I would have to go through like a state by state licensing process just to get licensed. If I wanted to do it myself. So just to get licensed.
You personally would have to get licensed. Your remote game server would have to get licensed. Your company would have to get licensed. And the game has to be approved in each state.
Yeah.
So I am guessing that if you decided to do it, I don't think you could do it for under $2 million. And years of, just as an example, my personal application, not the company's, mine, my personal application to the state of New Jersey was 29 pounds of paper. Now, I am on my first wife. I have no alimony. I have no judgments. From a regulatory standpoint, I am the most boring human being you will ever meet. There are no asterisks in my application. Everything is pretty much filled in the blanks. And that was 29 pounds. Imagine someone who's on their third wife with alimony, with, I can't imagine it. And you have to have the, you have to have the cash flow to sustain the years involved.
Yeah. And that's before you've got a customer, right? So that's just to get licensed, because the operators won't talk to you until you're licensed. Cause what's the point? So it's, so your product offering sounds fantastic then, in terms of, look, this, if your product is good enough, there is a quicker conduit to market from a, and I think that that's obviously kind of in other markets as well, those kind of game aggregators is huge. And is it online and land-based, or is it just one or the other? How does that work?
We are primarily online, but our games, as a byproduct, go into social casinos, or simulated gaming is another word for it. Titles that are good, right now the marketplace is going land-based, is directing online. Anything good land-based, there's a very good chance that online will be successful. We believe as time goes on, online, which is a much easier path to market, will dictate what gets made in the casinos and land-based, because that's even a harder business where you need to bring boxes. And the biggest difference is in online, there's no capacity issue. On land-based, every game that goes in, a truck has to come and take another game out.
Yeah, exactly. So it's a much easier way to test games online.
And faster.
Find your winners and then, you know, then take a decision of bringing it to the land base, which is, so it's a lower risk product launch.
And the cost is a fractal. To make an online game is a smidgen of what a land-based box costs. And the time to market is years. Our process, contract to casino, is about 6 months.
Wow.
Which is, that's pretty fast.
It's very fast. That's fantastic.
So our phone has been ringing off the hook. We have some amazing developers, European studios. You're probably familiar with GameArt.
Yep.
They are providing games for us. Habanero is one of our premier game providers. Galaxy Games and Felt Games are providing us table games. Those are the kinds of people that have found us. I'd like to tell you that we've really gone out and sold the world. We haven't. We literally have answered our phone.
That's kind of a nice way to do it, though, isn't it?
It's wonderful. And it's a win-win because these are people that don't know how to get in the North American market. And I'm trying to be politically correct, but it is harder for a non-American to get a license than an American company.
Yeah,
It's yet another layer of bureaucracy that takes some amount of time.
The form, because I've done the licensing process for a different business, and one of the funny things is that the form, all the application forms you fill in, assume you're American. So yes. There's no, like, even just at a very basic level, the form is designed for people with a social security number that live in America.
Yes.
So even at a basic level, it's more complicated. So I agree with that.
Super. So in that respect, we are a plug and play solution. You bring a game, it gets engineered onto our server, and the distribution, you know, the beauty of this business is once we are connected to an operator, they're dragging us along as every new state comes along. And we're already integrated with them. So the only real hurdle right now, the buzz is that Indiana is the next state to go live. All of our partners will go there, and we will just get dragged into the market. We'll go get our licenses, and there's no integrations required. And the game's already online.
That's
interesting. Is there, in terms of US players, Is there any particular sort of mathematical bent that they lean towards? Is there, you know, history will supposedly tell you that Asian players like a much higher volatility game, for example. But is there anything, any particular mechanics that apply, that appeal to US players?
Great question. There are two distinct online players. The first one is the one you envision, a 57-year-old overweight woman drinking bourbon and smoking cigarettes. That is the prototypical, also that's the prototypical land-based casino player. Well, that's who it is. We can spin it any way you want, but when you go to the casino, that's the lady sitting in the corner. And there are lots of those ladies in every casino. And those ladies are very good customers. They have built the casinos. The problem with those ladies is they are beginning to die off. And as they die off, younger people, guys your age, are not playing five reel spinning slots. You guys grew up on video games. You guys grew up with a much higher velocity game and probably are only going to engage gaming if we provide something interesting to you that you don't have. And it's got to be somewhat, I don't want to use the word skill-based, but you have to be engaged in it. Young people are playing table games. Young people are playing crash games. That's probably the biggest product that's being embraced, and that non-slot machine gambling device, I think, is where we are headed. I think we have seen enough five-wheel spinning machines, whether it's dogs or cats or hippos or flaming swords or Egyptians or Asian themes. It's kind of same. And your generation does not play slots. So
what do you think that you're saying about slots all being the same sort of thing, but there are certain themes that work globally.
Yes.
And Egyptian is certainly one of those. But one of the ones that I've never quite understood, and I'm not dissing the game when I say this at all, not even slightly. The one that's always had me wondering about its appeal. Because I'm going to stick my neck out a little bit here. I'm going to say that the average player is not sitting there and thinking about the mathematics of the game.
No, the average player wants to escape their life.
They are playing. If the game does a certain thing that they like, they will stick with it. And it's pretty much that simple. But the first part of that appeal is a visual one. They walk in, they see X, whatever it might be. And I've seen some beautiful, I'm talking physical slots now, but it's a similar sort of process in terms of luring us as animals. I saw a beautiful Ferris Bueller's Day Off slot, but for the license, they couldn't get Matthew Broderick. So it was a Ferris Bueller's Day Off slot without Ferris.
That's fairly common.
There was a Top Gun slot, which was WMS, if I remember correctly.
Tom Cruise wouldn't do it.
No, it was a beautifully done cabinet and all of that, but there was Kelly McGillis standing on her own. But it's the one that I constantly look at it and I'm like, I don't quite understand the perennial appeal of this as a theme, and that's Buffalo.
Buffalo is magic.
But it's amazing, isn't it? I mean, whoever struck that particular seam of gold, it's staggering. I was in Red Rock a few years ago, and I was with somebody from one of the slot companies, and we were looking at their installation in there, and they had these beautiful slots. I mean, the big curved, stunning, brand new slots, really, really beautiful. And can you guys hear my dog?
Yeah, just
yes. My dog's right here too, though.
The cleaning lady is about to come in, Val, and he absolutely loves her, so he's about to make a noise. That banging you can hear, that's his tail.
I see his tail, yeah.
Yeah. So we're in there, and basically nobody was playing these shiny new machines. Everybody was on these crusty old Buffalo slots they got. And I was just looking at this. I was like, that's that indefinable thing. Magic, like you say.
Well, the magic is the math. The first $20 you can get in any machine. You can get anybody to put $20 in any new machine on the floor. The question is whether you can get somebody to put the second 20 in. And that's the magic. And the magic is the math. The magic is how the ride feels.
Dog's going a bit mad in the background. Sorry about that.
Very happy dog.
He is very happy. He does really like Val. As I like to say, I think he just likes it when the house is clean.
Because she goes home.
And that only happens once a week. he is very, very happy. So in terms of themes, like, how do you guide your developers? Do you look at their catalogs and say, we think this will work, we think that will work? Or do you go to them with ideas, or do you just go, yeah, we just take whatever you got?
No, we first of all, think of us as a store. We are very boutique-y. We are looking for certain niche items. We are not looking to be a commodity. So an example, we need an Egyptian game. We need a Buffalo game. We need an Asian game. We need a Crash game. We need a Fruits game. Those are the check boxes in our, we need blackjack. We need poker. We need video poker. And everything we do, particularly table games, have to be unique because the operators will not revenue share on a commodity game. If we made a blackjack game, just a generic blackjack, we would probably be able to sell it once. But that's not our business model. Our business model is revenue share. So the only way we can revenue share are things like Galaxy Games, where they take standard blackjack and pair it with side bets. That's how we curate what we're doing, so that we are offering unique niche games that people don't have, and we are rounding out of space. We are not trying to compete with Aristocrat on Buffalo. They've got 75 different, Buffalo One, Son of Buffalo, Daughter of Buffalo, Niece of Buffalo, Buffalo's Cousin, Buffalo's Uncle.
Buffalo Prom Date. We've all played that
one. Yeah.
Yeah. There are some tremendous side bets out there now. Table game side bets are some really cool stuff. Like the company that I've looked at, I mean, you mentioned Galaxy and they're doing some wonderful stuff. I mean, back in the day, you would look at, for your table games, you'd look at Shuffle Master.
Which is now part of Light and Wonder.
Industrial Light and Gambling. But you would look at them as being like that. That's Nike. Now, I think Galaxy have got, like say, they've got some really tremendous product. There's a British roulette company called Kame who've done some fabulous side bets for roulette. You know, they're wheel makers, and so it's coming at it from that, you know, they understand their RNG. So they're like, well, you know, we've got all this data coming off the wheel. What do we do with it next? And they've got a couple of beautiful side bets out there, which I think, you know, when you see a development like that, you look at it, you think that's going to be the big driver for their business over the next few years. That's going to be their big growth.
That's the kind of opportunity that we are looking for, just to give you an example, because they are in the game making business. They are not in the game operating business.
Well, that's CAMMEGH, just in case you want to make a note there. You probably want to talk to Andrew or Richard. There you go. But yeah, I mean, you know, their wheels are known throughout the industry, but they've got this lovely intellectual property now, which is, you know, it's a different beast entirely. So it's, yeah, some really interesting shit out there now. Some really, really good stuff.
One question for me is, obviously you're dealing with a lot of like international game developers and stuff. And when I look at the US market, for the online US market, real money, and when you look at the winner, like who's winning, who's got the biggest market share, who's growing fast, it's very much the US brands, the US focused operators, more or less. Now, obviously, you know, there's some ownership stuff and things, but realistically, it's the Americans are winning ultimately in the American market.
Yeah, it's the big five: BetMGM, Golden Nugget, DraftKings, FanDuel.
Yeah.
There's one more, Rush Street.
Rush Street. And I think when you look at the European brands who came over with their European brands and their European product, and obviously they've adapted a little bit for the US market, for the particularly on the sports betting side, they haven't got the same traction. And what I'm curious with from the game developer's perspective that you're working with, and obviously you're curating and you're making sure things are right, is there like fundamental thinking or fundamental things that the game studios need to think about? Okay, this is being designed for a US audience, therefore we need to take these things into account, where in Europe we would do things this way. Is there those kind of disconnects?
First of all, the biggest factor of a game is appetite for volatility. That's the prime directive. We are a more volatile market, and we have more lines than the European market. And it's not right or wrong, good or bad.
Yeah, it's that's just preference. Yeah,
that's what is succeeding. So the legacy European games that are based on European tastes are not doing as well here. But you are dealing with very, very smart people, and you're dealing with very accomplished, very dedicated people. They will get it right, and just like fashion, they will fine-tune it. And, you know, the best example I can give you is in this country, when we would see rainbow-colored athletic shoes, we knew it was people from Europe. Americans didn't wear non-black or white athletic shoes.
I've experienced that. I had some green, bright lime green trainers, and I was in an elevator in a hotel in Atlantic City, and two guys get in, look at my shoes, and then just laughed the entire way up to my room. It was very funny.
Okay, but now that fashion embracement is part of American culture. Everybody has wild colored shoes. And that's kind of the same thing that's going to happen with gaming. As it gets fine tuned, these wonderful companies are going to be, you know, the front runners. Aristocrats Australian, I mean, just as a perfect example, they're the ones that brought the five wheel slot here 25, 30 years ago.
And they've been absolutely killing it the last few years on the land-based slots. They've been totally dominant.
Okay.
But a few years before that, they're on the bones of their ass.
Yeah.
Cycles.
So it cycles, and there will be a level playing field of game developers to where you won't really know the difference.
Got it.
Really so, good. Stephen, I've got a slightly off topic question. As a mature gentleman, we could call this a survey of the grey market. Do you use any streaming services for entertainment?
Do I personally?
Yes.
Sure. Spotify, Netflix, Hulu, Roku, Peacock Network. How am I doing? Apple, iTunes.
He's got everything. He's got everything.
Very impressive.
I realize that I work for a geeky company, and I've come from a geeky industry, so that's all worn off on me. From a tech-savvy standpoint, I am pretty okay.
Okay. With the second company that you mentioned there was Netflix. Are you familiar with a show called Cobra Kai?
Yes, but I've not watched it. Should I?
I think so.
Okay.
It's a continuation of the Karate Kid story.
Okay. I saw all the Karate Kids.
Well, Fenton, I'm not giving the magic away when I say this. I'm not.
No, you're not. You're fine.
It subverts the original dynamic. So in that first series, you'll see that Daniel LaRusso, the hero of the Karate Kid, is the villain. And Johnny, the villain of the Karate Kid, is the hero in Cobra Kai.
Okay, next bad day, we'll watch it.
It's an interesting journey, let's just say. And the first couple of series in particular are very funny.
Okay. I'm not
touting for Netflix customers. It's just something we ask our guests. Do you have a favorite Christmas film?
It's A Wonderful Life with Jimmy Stewart.
Great choice.
It's probably from the 40s, 50s maybe?
That is a good question. It's kind of Frank Capra's peak years, so I'm going to say it was the 50s. But you know what? Mrs. Smith Goes to Washington was about 48, wasn't it? I'm going to have to look this up. I'm so sorry.
Anyhow, just for where you're headed, we're fooling with ChatGPT, just as really? An example of... I've been trying to actually write press releases on it. And I'm not succeeding.
1946. Wow. Yeah, I've seen some people playing around with ChatGPT, and it is really, really interesting. But
it's frozen in, I think, 2020.
I think there's you could argue this is kind of the problem with the internet. Like if you were using it on a closed network, if you were using it on like a company intranet, then you could probably generate a lot of useful shit with it. But when it's out scouring the internet for this, that, and the other, and there is a huge amount of misinformation out there, and I do mean it, really stunning volume of bullshit on the internet, as we all know. But it, depending on what links, it can go and drag all that bullshit back and present it as fact. And
right. Yeah. The party trick one is ask ChatGPT about Hillary Clinton's presidency. It will write you a complete essay on something that never happened.
And it'll be I agree with that. It can be confidently incorrect. And you'd literally have to fact check anything it gives you in terms of, but the thing about this is it's some interesting things with this. One is that the data set it's trained on, the next version is like many multiples bigger data set. So it's going to.
Our company doesn't exist in ChatGPT. We came after the closed universe that ChatGPT is in. So until it catches up and gets out to the internet, to the real-time world, it's not particularly useful.
Yeah, but
for what I'm trying to do with it.
I agree. But I think it'll rapidly accelerate.
Yes.
And I also think it'll be, because there's a lot of talk, like, what about like Meta and like Facebook or Google, and they should do their stuff. Really interesting comment I saw was the big like corporates with their AI tools have to be so careful because they don't want to get sued. So actually their AI tools are typically really boring, where something like ChatGPT, which is your kind of challenger, okay, it's not a startup anymore, but it is that kind of challenger brand in that space, can push boundaries, take a bunch of risks, doesn't matter if it's wrong, and just get going. And I think it's going to be a really interesting dynamic over the next couple of years. As
ChatGPT is going to win. It's going to be embedded in Microsoft Office, just like Teams is going to beat Zoom ultimately, not because it's better, bigger, faster, stronger, but it's part of your Microsoft Office suite, and we just have Teams and use Teams. They are in a position that they're going to win.
That Microsoft sales team and their connection with the CTOs is an impressive moat for Microsoft for these kind of products. Because I've seen it, right, where I've been in a company where everybody uses Slack, and then the Microsoft sales team starts talking to the CTO, hey, this is Windows, you should be using Teams. And then all of a sudden the company mandate comes out of everybody onto Teams, we're getting rid of Slack.
Nobody ever gets fired for buying Microsoft.
Exactly. Ever. It's safe. It's safe. It's
you
super
say that, but I, Stephen, you'll remember this. We recorded another podcast earlier today, and I was telling Fintan to look up.
I'm not your first.
So indignant. I told him to look up the Windows 95 launch video and that horrendous clip of the Microsoft board dad dancing on stage to the Rolling Stones as they unveiled Windows 95. Yep, that's the one, see? It is a legendary video, Fintan. You have to watch this.
I've seen clips of it. I have seen clips of it. I know the one you're talking about.
It's a beautiful thing. And they're all dressed up for it so well. If anybody out there has got any information on anybody being fired for buying Microsoft, please get in touch. Because I hate using Microsoft products. Not because they're Microsoft, but because I use an Apple computer. And they've historically never worked particularly well with Apple computers.
No, we are all Mac. And in fact, Teams just makes us miserable. There is a real challenge on a Mac using Teams.
And I was using the free version of Teams. So I've got Microsoft Office Suite or whatever. But the free version of Teams, I guess maybe Teams doesn't come in that bundle. I don't know. And I was had an ordeal. I was getting hold of the CEO of a fairly major casino operator to do an interview this week, right? And we finally get together and they're like, can we use Teams? I'm like, yeah, we can use Teams. Get him on Teams. I'm like, right, do you know how to record on this? And he's like, yeah, you press the three dots, you go to this thing, and I look and I see you can't record on the free version.
Oh.
So Teams just earned itself an uninstallation and a 1 star out of 5 would not recommend from me.
Couldn't exist if this video chat didn't exist. We couldn't be in business. The amount of people around the globe that I talk to every single day is a matter of fact for free. Is a real critical component. Before I talked to you guys, you weren't first in my life either. I was on a call to South Africa where we had to set the times up. That my very early morning worked for them, and the call wasn't valuable enough to get on an airplane and go to South Africa for. Except without the ability to interact, we would not have a relationship with this casino operator. So this video chatting has been really the linchpin. And with COVID particularly, we were all locked in our houses and we were working 70-hour weeks, you know, with our dogs and in our bedrooms.
But I do think that the weather in South Africa is probably quite a bit better than the weather in Chicago.
Much better. They pointed that out. And they showed me pictures outside.
Yeah.
That's the first thing everybody in nice weather, the first thing they want to do is gloat at it and stick it in your face when you're...
you know, you are in Chicago. Everything I've ever learned about Chicago has come from two sources. Three sources, sorry, I should say. That is not in order of importance. The Untouchables movie. So obviously it's a very dangerous place to live.
Then Batman 2.
No. John Hughes films.
Mm-hmm.
And Sarah Paretsky books.
So you've never been?
No, but I don't need to.
Okay. It is the greatest city in the world in the summer. No, in the summer, other than Paris, I would say it's really probably the second best city in the world.
But even summer. London is nice in the summer, you know?
London is nice, but it's not as nice a place as Chicago in the summer. In London in winter, in Chicago in winter, we're having a misery contest. I'm not sure. You know, London is not as cold, but it's gray and depressing in the winter.
Yeah, it's got that special kind of dampness as well.
Yeah.
It's not great. But it's good that they hold ice in February.
Yeah. Well, if they held in Aruba in February, that would be a good thing. I'd be all over that.
Anywhere else in February. But they announced today, I don't know if you guys saw this, and this will date when we're recording this, they announced today the, I love the way they phrase this, the finalists for where ICE might be in the future, like it's a fucking TV talent show.
Oh, yeah. What's the shortlist?
That, Fintan, is a great question. I'm going to go find it. Hang on. There it is. Host city finalists, right? Determine the future location of ICE, widely recognized, world's biggest, most international business-to-business gaming event. They've had some specialist consultants working on this. And they have a final shortlist of four cities. Actually, that can't be right. Oh, no, it is. This is the actual press release. Sorry, it's just it says all of which meet the exacting criterion set out in the process. But criterion is singular. It should be the exacting criteria set out in the process. So that's a little bit annoying. The quartet of potential host cities comprise...
Just give us the cities, John.
No, this was written in ChatGPT.
Just give us the cities. Come on.
Fucking...
Oz and Never Never Land. Candyland.
Barcelona, London, Madrid, and Paris.
Strange.
Now, I reckon we can rule...
Paris would be perfect.
Three of those out straight away. And I tell you why. Oh. Right? I don't think Barcelona has a venue that's big enough.
What? It's got the massive conference. It does the...
Yeah. Now, it has got a big venue.
Yeah.
Which is in an absolutely shithole area.
But it's good enough for the Mobile World Congress, whatever they do, or whatever that big mobile one is in January.
I'm not saying that people don't use it. I'm just saying it's in a shitty area.
You will get mugged at nighttime. Yes, that is for sure.
I won't.
You won't, but
you will. You will.
I would. I'm too pretty. Yeah.
That's it. You'd be like, not my face. It's my living. I don't think Barcelona, like if that was in a different part of the city, fair enough, but it's not. London, because, you know, Brexit, first and foremost. One of the things that I saw, I might be wrong about this, but There's a quote on this from Alex Pratt, Group Managing Director Clarion Gaming, who has been on the podcast in the past. He says, hang on. The ability to accommodate projected future growth. The process also encompasses dateline availability, transport connectivity with the rest of the world, as well as a broader hospitality infrastructure, including accommodation costs. That's quite important. And I would say that rules Paris out.
Yeah.
Paris is very expensive.
Yeah.
So you've got the two most expensive cities in Europe in there, in London and Paris.
So it'll be Lisbon then, because that's where they do the big tech, whatever that big tech conference, the
Irish. Lisbon would be fabulous. But of those four, Madrid's the obvious one.
Oh, sorry. Lisbon wasn't on the list.
No, Barcelona, London, Madrid, Paris.
Ah.
Madrid's really easy to get around in too.
Yeah, it's a good venue.
International airport.
Yep. Big enough city. You know, I mean, it ticks all the boxes. It's not hugely expensive.
Hmm.
And like I say, the venue is pretty much just right and is expandable because it's like a multi-hall venue.
Hmm.
The only potential bugbear there is already a gaming show in it. So it's how do they tackle that? But
no, I think they can just move in.
But I've seemed to remember talking to somebody about this. I can't remember who it was. And I've got a feeling that they said that the gaming event there has some tie to the venue. I might be wrong about that. I might be remembering something different, but there's something about that event that means it's not, you know, it's not going to be some pushover to move kind of thing. But you know, it's going to be an interesting process. Each city.
Earl's Court was so convenient. Earl's Court is one of the nastiest places I've ever been, but it was so convenient and so easy to get to.
And such a beautiful building.
It is a beautiful building. The pigeons, though, sort of got me a little uneasy sometimes when they'd fly by your booth.
Dirty pigeons. But it's each city will be making a formal bid to host ICE for the period 2025 to 2029. Announcement scheduled for third quarter 2023. Maybe we can get them to do that on this podcast, Fintan.
I'm sure.
If we keep growing. You never know.
You never know.
Stephen, sorry to hold you up with the idle chit-chat. Thank you very, very much for joining us. It's been very interesting hearing about Odds Works and competing in Land of the Giants.
We are David and Goliath, so it's pretty exciting.
It is. It is. I love
it. It's only a matter of time before those roles are reversed and you're looking around at the competition thinking, who shall I crush?
By then, I hope I am retired.
You're never going to retire.
Yeah.
You're not fooling us.
If you were going to retire, Stephen, you would have by now.
You're having too much fun. Fair.
I actually have retired, and I was really, really bad at it.
Yeah.
It does look kind of boring.
It does. How much golf can you really play, right? It's rubbish.
Well, there's a honey-do list. And, you know, all the stuff that's one of these days. Well, when you have nothing to do, you get it done real fast. And when you get to the bottom of the list, it's like, okay, I'm not going to die, but I don't have anything to do today. So I'll manufacture something.
That is why the baby Jesus made methadone. For those long, long days.
There are no long days today. It's pretty exciting.
Brilliant.
Thank you, Stephen.
Gentlemen, a pleasure. Thank you.
If you've enjoyed this episode of the Gambling Files podcast, please find us on LinkedIn. Give us a big, juicy, succulent like. That nearly went wrong. You can find us under the name The Gambling Files Podcast. You can find us on Twitter under The Gambling Files. I think the handle is just at Gambling Files. You can connect to myself, John Bruford, or Fintan Costello, also on LinkedIn. We're also both on Twitter. And you can find all of our previous episodes at
www.thegamblingfiles.com. If you enjoyed it, please share, tell your friends, tell your family, tell your colleagues, and we'll see you next time.